Hi, and welcome to our special edition of the Cure Talks Cancer Podcast, hosted with our sister publication, OncLive. Each week, we'll be hearing from patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, and healthcare professionals to do what Cure does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education. This week, Cure and OncLive spoke with a patient-doctor duo on myeloproliferative neoplasms, what they are, how they're treated, and how patients can talk to their doctors to be their own best advocates. Keep listening to learn more from Dr. Ruben Mesa from UT Health San Antonio and his patient, Auntie, who was diagnosed with essential thrombocythemia in 1992.
Auntie, to start, can you just tell us a little bit about what led to your diagnosis?
Yes, sure. So after having been a very healthy, active 49-year-old, I suddenly developed severe migraine episodes. And they were so bad I would have to leave work and sleep them off in a darkened room. I went to my primary care physician and he couldn't find any cause and suggested taking pain pills. I didn't feel comfortable with that, so I seeked the help of another doctor. I went to see seek a second opinion, and she sent me immediately to a hematologist because of the lab work showing 2.6 million platelet count. Then I went to the hematologist, and he did a bone marrow biopsy, confirmed that diagnosis, and then asked me to see his mentor at UCSF, who had just completed a trial, interferon versus anagrelide, and that was in 1992.
Dr. Mesa, could you highlight kind of the current state of ET and really like the current prognosis, what that looks like for these patients?
Patients with essential thrombocythemia, you know, have a disease that in the short term can affect them in terms of symptoms, elevation in the blood counts, a risk of blood clots or bleeding, and more rarely, enlargement of the spleen. And how it affects everyone is very different on that basis, whether there is significant risk of blood clots or bleeding, whether that was how we found the disease to begin with, as well as what is that risk in the future. Second, there is a risk of the disease potentially progressing over time to either an advanced phase, which we call myelofibrosis, or rarely to acute leukemia. Fortunately, the majority of patients with essential thrombocythemia will live out their normal lifespan, and it is a minority of individuals that have progressive disease. Even in those that do live a normal lifespan, we need to be very mindful of the disease, and we need to try to control it to help to both minimize the burden of symptoms as well as to decrease that risk of blood clots or bleeding.
Yeah, and so with that, I know it sounds like it's a lot of information to take in. So, Auntie, what ran through your mind when you heard the words that you have cancer and given your diagnosis is kind of on the rarer side?
Yes, that's a very excellent question. This is 1992, and cancer, that word was not used for these conditions. The physician said that I had a myeloproliferative disorder, and my life expectancy at that time showed 15 years. Well, that of course devastated me. I mean, I had a family and an active life. And so when he said that just, it was just horrible. So thankfully, we don't say that anymore these days, or the doctors don't. But since he sent me to a mentor who knew and had researched these disorders and who made me feel at ease right away, he explained everything very calmly and gave me the options of treatments. And one of them was interferon that he suggested because of my age, being 49 years old. And I understood a little bit more about the disease that before when I heard the word you have a myeloproliferative disorder, I had never heard that before, and I didn't have no idea what it was. So I was very thankful to this gentleman who just took some of the fear away and explained things in terms that I could understand.
And going off of that, Dr. Meso, do you have advice for delivering these obviously very difficult conversations to your patients or for other healthcare professionals as well as trying to talk about them with their patients?
The discussion they have around essential thrombocythemia is a complex one because it is technically a cancer. It is technically a leukemia. It's a clonal neoplasm, just as clonal as any other cancer. All of that said, its behavior is really quite different than what people associate with either of those two very emotion-inducing words. You know, what first, I try to frame the disease as a chronic disease. And there are many other chronic diseases that patients are much more familiar with. Diabetes, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, high blood pressure. You know, these are different diseases, but they're diseases that are chronic. They're diseases we typically do not have cures for. These are diseases that there, yes, there is a subset of people who may pass away from complications from those diseases, but the majority of people will live out their normal lifespan. So it's a fairly good analogy for essential thrombocythemia. You know, I view every patient who has this disease, you know, there is a lot of education which needs to occur. Maybe all of that can be done with a first visit. Maybe they are so overwhelmed or really lack insight into the disease sufficient that you really can't cover all of these points really on that first visit. But I think it's important to be very mindful of what we know and what we don't know. Indeed, as Angie had mentioned, she was told that the life expectancy was 15 years. Well, that is probably true, but a little misleading because the average age at which we find the disease is in the mid-60s. So an average life expectancy of 15 years is the average life expectancy in the United States. So although that number is true, that doesn't mean that those were individuals who passed away from essential thrombocythemia and included people who lived 50 years and then died of, you know, a car accident. So I think it's important to realize when you're visiting with a patient, this is probably the first time they've heard anything about a disease like this and don't really have a frame of reference. And to be very cautious and clear in terms of trying to explain it in terms that that patient's likely to understand. And then I revisit the key parts of that discussion every time I visit with them, because sometimes it takes a few visits for them to kind of slowly get familiar with the disease, as well as sometimes to frame some of the online reading that they may be doing in parallel with our discussions.
Absolutely. And so you just gave a lot of good advice on that patient-doctor conversation. Auntie, how did you learn more about your diagnosis and what was your experience in talking with your doctor to learn more?
I learned about my diagnosis. First, he gave me literature. He wanted me to be the one to help him decide which treatment I would want to go on. Since I've been always quite proliferative and had to be on treatment without a break, he gave me the options of the three available treatments at that time. And the literature also explained exactly the nature of the disease and side effects and symptoms. So that helped a lot. And in regards to the treatments, it was pretty clear to me that after reading about the other two options, hydroxyurea at that time, a chemo medication, and then an anagrelide, and listening to his suggestions, that I chose interferon. And from then on, I continued to educate myself about my disease and find out anything I could to be more in control and being able to help and communicate with the doctor and help in my future treatments.
Thank you. And Dr. Mesa, we've obviously done a lot of work before in talking about how difficult it can be to diagnose patients with MPNs. Can you kind of speak to some of the just overall challenges in diagnosis, and we can go into specifics with essential thrombocythemia?
So the diagnosis of an MPN certainly begins with a suspicion based on either a blood clot that occurred in an unexpected location. So we know that blood clots in the portal venous system, in the splanchnic vein, in various unexplained thrombotic events have a much higher rate of having a myeloproliferative neoplasm. Most commonly, it's because of either a finding on the peripheral blood, clear erythrocytosis, elevation in the red cell count, unexplained elevation in the platelets, more rarely unexplained elevation in the white cell count, or splenomegaly. One of those sorts of things, you know, clearly can be the case. Over time, I think we have had much greater diagnostic certainty by the discovery of the JAK2 V617F mutation that can now be easily tested by peripheral blood, as well as the less common but important driver mutations of calreticulin or MPL. I'd say in 2020, one of the challenges that remain is that individuals who have been found to have the increase in the count and are found to have the JAK2 mutation, there is still a reluctance to obtain a bone marrow biopsy. And particularly as it relates to essential thrombocythemia, the majority of individuals that have the JAK2 mutation and thrombocytosis will have ET, but not everyone. These individuals still might have a associated MPN-MDS overlap syndrome, such as RARST or CMML, or they may have myelofibrosis or early myelofibrosis. Even much more rarely, there have been individuals who truly have chronic myeloid leukemia and have a small incidental JAK2 mutation that was present as well. So I do find that the diagnostic workup for ET is sometimes incomplete, and you have individuals assuming they have ET where they really have, more accurately, a cousin disorder, and that might have important implications in terms of choice of therapy and or prognosis.
Okay. So I know we've talked about diagnosis, but maybe if we could get into treatment a little bit. So Antti, I know you'd mentioned that you were on interferon. Could you just briefly describe your treatment regimens and what you've been on since then?
Yes, sure. I began with interferon. That form of interferon was the short-lasting interferon, and the injections were 3 times a week. Then after several years, that became inactive, somewhat inactive, and lost some efficacy. And I switched to hydroxyurea for 14 years. Again, and I was on 500 to 1,000 milligram a day. After that proved to lose a bit of efficacy, I switched to Pegasus, a pegylated interferon, and was on it for about 5 years, usually about between 45 and 80 mcgs. I'm quite drug sensitive, and now I am on a combination of hydroxyurea and pegylated interferon, both low dosages. Mm-hmm.
And so, Dr. Mesa, could you kind of highlight in more clinical terms kind of the treatment that she has been on, and how this kind of compares to some of the other regimens that we have in the armamentarium?
Of course. Essential thrombocythemia, the treatment goals, really, we need to start with the goals. And what are the goals? Trying to control the symptoms, trying to ideally have the platelet count under 400,000 to try to decrease the risk of blood clots and bleeding, and to have the therapy be well tolerated. Those are all the key goals. There's a further goal of trying to avoid progression in the disease, although that is a more difficult goal to quantify. Angie's experience is like that of many others, where first therapy begins with a baby aspirin. Almost everyone receives it. But she's been on a combination of really our two kind of frontline therapies. Our current US-based NCCN guidelines, you know, have both hydroxyurea and interferon alpha and long-acting interferon or pegylated interferon as available options in the frontline for ET, of which neither one is technically FDA approved for that reason, but they've both been available, they've both been efficacious. There now have been randomized studies comparing them. And in ET, they're relatively equivalent. Some pluses, some minuses, some differences in side effect profile, maybe a slight advantage with interferon in terms of avoiding disease progression. In polycythemia vera, where there have been further randomized studies, it's probably more clear that interferon is slightly better than hydroxyurea. I wouldn't say dramatically. In fact, I had that conversation with a patient this morning that said that affording interferon was just going to be very difficult for her, you know. And again, in the ideal world, if the interferon works for you and it can be covered or you're able to pay for it, it may be slightly better. Now, in Angie's case, as with others, frequently enough of either of the medicines to fully control the counts can lead to side effects that are unacceptable. So there are individuals who will feel better with a little bit of two agents as opposed to a lot of one agent. All of these agents have a very dose-tied set of side effects. And sometimes a little bit lower dose is better tolerated and puts things in better balance. It's part of the trying to personalize the therapy for an individual so that it can decrease the symptoms, control the counts, but ideally control the amount of side effects from the therapy as well.
Definitely. And so with that, I know it can feel like a lot of information sometimes, but ideally, we always want patients to be their own best advocates. So, Antti, why do you think it's important for patients to be knowledgeable about their treatment and their diagnosis so that they can be their own best advocates?
Yes, wonderful question. Being knowledgeable about disease symptoms and our conditions and current new treatments and their side effects helps us to discuss with our doctors the best road forward to treat our condition and decide which is right for us as an individual. MPN patients are all so very complex and different. We have different side effects to different treatments. We have different symptoms. And so it's not like a one for all solution. So knowing about yourself, those two advocating for yourself and sharing this with your physician, he's the educated person to help you, and he sees many patients with your illness, but you are the one who knows your body best, and so you know how you feel and how certain things make you react. And a good doctor-patient relationship is just plays a very vital role in managing our condition. So being an advocate is one of those things for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Thank you. So kind of in bouncing off of that, Dr. Mesa, do you have resources that you recommend that as we've obviously gained more knowledge in the MPN field over the last several years, any resources that you can recommend for physicians who are treating these patients, as well as for patients themselves?
Most certainly. So I think there's good educational information out there, both online and certainly with, you know, in-person events and national meetings and things of that nature. There's a great online content from Patient Power, from OncLive, from PERF, from Total CME, from there are many platforms that really have been very robust, you know, and in particular, take individuals through frequently both updates as well as kind of case-based sort of discussions regarding, you know, new options, how they're applied, as well as how we balance things in challenging situations. You know, indeed, I like to say, you know, medicine is clearly both art and science, and that has been well recognized. The science is knowing what the options are. You know, we know for ET, that's Hydrea, that's pegylated interferon, that potentially might be in some a JAK inhibitor like ruxolitinib, that rarely can be other therapies, you know, busulfan, you know, or even other chemotherapeutic drugs. We know there are a lot of things that are not. We know that we would not use Herceptin. You know, we know that we would not use, pembrolizumab, on and on. There are a variety of things that really would not be in your arsenal. The art of medicine is really knowing what to use in which patient and then adjusting it in the appropriate way, knowing how long it really takes to see a response, really asking the right questions of the patient to really know whether they are tolerating the therapy or not. Are they better off for what you've prescribed, or is there a way to adjust it further? In a disease like ET, it's striving to try to get to a plateau where they feel reasonably well. It may not be perfect, but getting them to feel as well as they can in a way that they can be comfortable, that the side effects of the medicines are tolerable, the range of their counts are a range that you're content with in terms of protecting them against vascular events, and then you watch, and look and adjust. But once individuals hit that plateau, they might be in that plateau ideally for many, many years. So clearly trying to achieve a stable state is very important in a disease like ET.
And going off of that, you know, obviously patients want to achieve a stable state and have improved quality of life. So, Antti, why do you think it's important for patients and physicians to have vital communication when it comes to not just the diagnosis, but throughout the entire treatment paradigm to ensure that patients, you know, are achieving that stable disease and being able to have better quality of life and things like that?
Yes, well, very important to, like I mentioned before, to have a good doctor-patient relationship, to share how you feel and how this disease is acting in your daily life, and then finding answers on what can I do to feel better, like as far as, you know, exercise, diet, and those type of things. And people often smile at exercising. They just say, well, I'm so fatigued, I do not really feel like exercising. And it sounds counterproductive, but it helps so much. It's just amazing. It just a little exercise a day, how much better patients feel. So all just conveying openly about how you feel and anything that comes up that you don't understand, and you ask your doctor, and so he can explain it and he knows how you're doing and progressing.
Thank you. And then kind of just looking ahead to the future of this paradigm, Dr. Mesa, can you highlight any kind of ongoing research efforts looking to further improve outcomes for these patients?
Without question, we know that there are clear unmet gaps with essential thrombocythemia. There still are patients that progress. There still are patients that on the therapies that we have that have either unacceptable toxicities or they don't work well enough. You know, so one, there are several therapies in development. I mentioned earlier that ruxolitinib has been in phase 3 trials for patients with more refractory ET to try to identify, you know, what is the role of that therapy, particularly with patients with more difficult symptoms, splenomegaly, and who have failed hydroxyurea. You know, second, pegylated interferon alpha 2A, which is commonly used in the U.S., is not FDA approved. There's a new interferon, ropegylated interferon alpha 2B, from Pharmacentia that is now going to be in a phase 3 trial that Dr. Verstovchak from MD Anderson and I are co-leading an international study to try to show the benefit of that as second-line therapy compared to anagrelide in high-risk individuals who failed hydroxyurea, who have more difficult ET. Third, there may be benefit from LSD1 inhibition. There's a clinical trial developed by my colleague Robin Sherber from Imago Pharmaceuticals that will be tested in our site, as well as they'll have a company-sponsored study for patients with ET that have been refractory. So many other things in development. In addition, I think the science continues to evolve for us to better try to understand and predict who is it that is likely to progress? Are there markers of that progression early on in their course? Does that in any way give us a clue or insight as to which therapies we should be using or developing to try to help prevent that? You know, for the majority of patients with ET, if we keep them from progressing, they will live out their normal lifespan. So the avoidance of progression is a key goal that I think we still have a scientific gap in terms of having enough information to develop rationally designed drugs to really block and prohibit that disease progression. But I think it's a very bright future indeed.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cure Talks Cancer podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps to hear every episode, or visit curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cure Talks Cancer podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com and find us on Twitter at @cure_magazine or Facebook at @curemagazine.